So last week I was talking about the life of Milarepa and asking people who were here to engage with the life, as it were, from the inside, to try and find points of reference or points of resonance with the life. And we left Milarepa at the end of last week in a good place. So his ordeals and his trials were over. He'd been accepted by Marpa as a student who was going to give him initiations and teachings. And Milarepa said, "And my happy days began." So that was a relief, wasn't it? So apart from the bit of the life story I'm going to tell next, that is pretty much how it continues. His happy days began. And from then on, really, as his practice intensifies and his realizations deepen, the emotion that he expresses more and more, feels more and more, and expresses more and more, is joy, is a very deep-seated joy. But before we get to that point, there's another episode in the life story that I would like to tell you about. I find it a very poignant episode, and it resonates very strongly with me. So he receives the teachings, and he goes into solitary retreat for initially 11 months under Marpa's instruction. And he continues in that way in solitary retreat. And he breaks his solitary retreat twice. And this isn't considered very good because he's kind of under oath to stay in solitary retreat. The first time it's because of a dream. And this dream comes, as it were, from up here. It's a dream from a Dakini. And the Dakini in the dream tells him that there's a teaching that he doesn't have, that he needs. So to check that out, he breaks retreat and goes to see Marpa. And that's a whole other story. Anyway, Marpa goes off to India to find this teaching. That takes him 3 years, and you know, he gets imprisoned, he can't find Naropa, etc., etc. It's, you know, another whole episode in Marpa's life. And I suppose it shows that Marpa is willing to put his life on the line for the sake of the Dharma, for Milarepa, and for his other disciples. So it must be some time later, because it's after Marpa's come back, Milarepa's continued in solitary retreat, that he breaks his retreat the second time. So he's already been practicing for quite a long time. Presumably he's had quite a lot of realizations. So the second dream comes, as it were, from down here. It's a kind of depth dream, as it were, you could say. And he dreams, although he says he never normally slept. This time he dreams, and he dreams of his house, his home. The house of the four columns and the eight pillars. So this house has been in his family for quite a long time. Obviously, it's a very important place for him. It's where he grew up. It's also the scene of a lot of his unhappiness and troubles. And in the dream, he says that this house was in such a broken and dilapidated state that it looked like an old donkey's ears. Interesting metaphor. Can't quite work out what that would look like. And his field, which is also very important, the field and the land that they own, the field appeared to be overgrown with weeds. The books of scriptures were wet and damaged by water. My mother was dead, and my only sister was wandering friendless in the world. The grief I experienced at not having met my mother again since our parting under such unhappy circumstances so many years ago was heart-rending. So Milarepa, as ever, you know, feels things very, very strongly, very, very deeply. And I woke calling my mother's and sister's names and weeping bitterly. On waking, I saw that my pillow was wet with tears. When I attempted to think about it, the longing to see my mother only increased. And I could not stop weeping, and I made up my mind to see my aged parent again by any means possible. That's a very, very strong dream, isn't it? I'm sure you just have to sit with the kind of sense of that dream. His mother dead, his sister wandering friendless, the house in ruins. So sometimes, you know, we wake up and we have the end of a dream, don't we? And it just kind of disappears. Sometimes we wake up and we remember a dream and we write it down, and it's quite interesting. I don't know about you, but sometimes we have this kind of dream. I have sobbing dreams. I don't know about you. I wake up and I've been sobbing in my dream. Sometimes I know what it's about, sometimes I don't, in a way. It doesn't really matter, does it? It's just something very deep emerging. So that kind of dream. So I'm asking you, as I'm relating the life, to think about instances in your own life that might connect with you. So think about a dream you might have had. It really kind of comes from somewhere very deep. And it you can't shake it off. It just has a very strong effect on you. So that's the kind of dream that Milarepa has. So So he breaks his retreat. He can't, you know, he can't not. He just has to go and see Martha, and tells him about his anguish and his longing to see not just his mother, but his house, his sister, even to see if his aunt and uncle, who were so evil to him, were still alive, and the woman he was betrothed to. So Marpa says, well, you know, you told me that you had no reason to yearn for home and relatives. You told me that. And even if you go, you've been away so long that it's very unlikely you'll find your family alive in good health. But he gives him permission to go. Presumably he kind of gets a sense that it's just such a strong imperative for Minerepa. But Marpa also is a reader of signs and omens. He's very highly spiritually intuitive. And he says to Minerepa, if you do go, we will not meet again in this life. So, you know, there's another poignant situation, another loss, which I just going to burst into tears at the moment. Anyway, he agrees for him to go, and Minerepa's going to go. And he gives him final teachings and initiations and instructions. And he says to Minerepa, you have all the teachings that I have. You have everything. Don't think you don't, you do. Your faith, the teachings, and myself are one. So there's a very strong bond between them. He also says, I think this is very interesting, he says, my son, your going away breaks my heart. But all competent things are impermanent, so it can't be helped. So there's that sort of juxtaposition, isn't there, of an understanding of impermanence, but his going is going to break his heart. So he tells Minerepa to only spend 7 days and nights at home and then to go into a solitary retreat for the rest of his life. Which Minerepa, of course, does. And he gives him a secret scroll that's only to be opened if Minerepa's in grave physical danger. Then Damema starts to weep. There's a lot of weeping in the life of Minerepa, as we discovered last week. Damema starts to weep, Marpa's wife, and Marpa says to her, so why are you weeping? Why are you weeping? Minerepa's received all the instructions and is going to meditate upon them, so why weep? Why not weep for all sentient beings lost in the suffering of samsara? And she says, well, I don't know if my compassion is that developed. I weep now because I cannot help it. I've lost one son, so Marpa and Damema's son has died to death, and now I'm going to lose another. So faithful, energetic, intelligent, kind-hearted, willing, and faultless from every point of view. I'm going to lose while living. How can I help weeping? So then, of course, Marpa weeps, Minerepa weeps. Anyway, he's off, Minerepa. He's going to go. And the next morning, there are more ceremonies and rituals and teachings and so on. Damema, Minerepa, Marpa, and Minerepa's other disciples, there's a party of about 13 of them, I think, set off to walk Minerepa to the final point where they have to let him go. And when Damema sings her farewell song, the long pent-up grief of the others bursts forth in torrents of sobs and tears. And as they recede in the distance, Minerepa is looking back and says, my heart longed to rejoin them, but I tore myself away, consoling myself with the thought I have now obtained the truths in their entirety, and I could always meditate upon the Guru on the crown of my head as long as I lived. And anyway, I'm only going for a short time and I'll be back soon. So there's sort of two things about this story that strike me personally. One is I remember reading this, I don't know if it was the first time, but I remember reading this in the life of Minerepa many, many years ago, and had a very big effect on me. Because, you know, as I said last week, people in this story just seem to feel and express their emotions very strongly. There's no holding back, there's no stiff upper lip. And when I read this, I was a young Buddhist with some quite odd ideas about the Dharma. You know, I thought it was good to be non-attached and not to feel things and not to miss people and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think there were those kind of misunderstandings about Buddhism in those days. I'm sure there aren't these days. So it had a very strong effect on me that, you know, Marpa's enlightened and he has an understanding of impermanence and conditioned existence. Damema is supposed to be a Dakini. But they've got such strong dharmic and karmic links. You know, they love each other. Marpa loves Minerepa, his disciple, that they also feel, experience, and express their feelings. So that did have a big effect on me. I suppose the lesson it taught me was, you know, to get real, as it were, to get a bit more real, and not be so alienated from my feelings, and use Buddhist teachings to back that up. So I remember it having an enormous impact. I mean, we feel things and we need to feel those feelings, don't we? So Minarepa returns home. He arrives at the village where he grew up, and it's quite some distance away. And he talks to someone and discovers that no one goes to the house because everyone's so frightened of the demons there because of, you know, the hailstorms and the magic and so on. And that the house holds the corpse of his mother, and that his sister has wandered away, and that his mother has been dead for about 8 years. So, presumably Minarepa hoped that things would not be as they were in the dream, and he says, "The news of my mother's death and the disappearance of my sister filled my heart with despair and sorrow, and I hid myself and wept bitterly." So then the next day he goes to the house and he says, when I looked at the desolation and the ruin that met me, I was overwhelmed with despondency." Sorry, this is terribly sort of sad. It is sad. It's very poignant, isn't it? "And groping my way towards the outer rooms, I found a heap of earth and rags over which large quantities of weeds and grass had grown. On shaking it, I found it to be my mother's bones." So, I mean, just, you know, get inside this situation. His dream, it's so strong, he goes there. It's exactly as it was in the dream. He finds his mother's bones. So a very strong yearning arises in him. You know, he understands now that he won't see his mother again in this life. The last time he saw her was when she sent him off to wreak her vengeance for him. He never saw her again. So he makes a cushion of his mother's bones, and he sits upon his mother's bones as his cushion in clear, undistracted and tranquil meditation for 7 days. Because he remembers Martha's teaching, and he calls upon the blessings of his lineage in order to do that. And he realises he can save his mother and father from the miseries of samsaric existence. He knows a practice by which he can kind of move his mother's consciousness from the hell realm that she's in to liberation. So after all that, and I think this is very important in Minarepa's life, this is where he makes his final and most radical and deepest renunciation. So he deals with his mother's bones in the traditional way. He makes sure she has a proper burial. And then he resolves to sit in meditation and not give way to worldly ambition. So he says, "Worldly pursuits are worthless. The sight of the wretched condition of my home in ruins had affected me so deeply that I could not help but give up utterance to the resolution to live the life of a solitary hermit. And I repeated the resolution again and again in my heart." So there's been great sort of loss, great suffering, and he's seen very deeply into the nature of conditioned existence, and that's kind of pushed him ever deeper into the life he was already on, but it's kind of made him resolve that there's no point for him in pursuing worldly ambition. So I think it's very interesting what happens, that he's been practicing for quite a long time in retreat when he has this dream. He had renounced the world to meditate, but something arises, isn't it, very deep within him, very personal, very deep, a very deep grief, and a longing for home and mother he'd not seen for so long. So it's strong enough to take him out of retreat, strong enough for him to leave Marpa. So we would say Minarepa obviously had some more work to do, some work of integration. There was an experience, an unfinished business, as it were, there that kind of rose up that he needed to bring into consciousness, he needed to look at, he needed to deal with. And I suppose it just reveals, doesn't it, just how strong those kind of experiences are for us, those connections are for us. You know, it's his house, it's his mother, it's his roots. And a house is not just a house, is it? A house, in dream analysis, a house is the psyche, isn't it? You've got the upstairs, the consciousness, and the basement, the unconscious, and so on. So it's your psyche. And I suppose that's because you grow up in a house, and he lived in quite a stable society, so he would have grown up in the same house until he left it. Then the house is your world. It's all you know as a child, isn't it? So it's your psyche, it's your world. It's your roots, it's your soil, it's his mother. You know, it's the whole, you know, it's very, very strong, isn't it? And I know people move a lot these days, but I lived in the same house till I left home at 18. And then my mother lived in that house until she died a few years ago. So in my life, you know, there's one house that I have still have, very strong connection with. So for me, that house, such as it wasn't up to much, but it was my world when I was young. It was my psyche. It is my mother. I was very, very strongly identified with my mother because she was so strongly identified with it. And I dream about it. I dream about it a lot because it's kind of me. It's all those things. It's my memories. So I think, you know, we get a sense of how strong and deep those connections go. And he goes back, and the house is in ruins, isn't it? So there's both a kind of personal experience and a universal experience there, because I think it's all those things I've just described, the house for him. But it's like the burning house in the White Lotus Sutra, isn't it? It's not just his house, his loss, his mother. The house is a ruined house. So it's a metaphor for conditioned existence itself. And I suppose it's ruined. His house, his personal house, is ruined. Yes, because all things are impermanent, but also because it's also the seat of a lot of negative mental states, isn't it? A lot of negative mental activity. So it's got kind of karma and karma vipaka kind of woven into it, which is how the world is, samsara is anyway, isn't it? So it's a very, in a way, you just have to sit with the image, don't you? The house, the mother, all that, and you know, let that kind of speak to you. So I suppose it also says something for us about, or something for me about, the spiritual life isn't necessarily a smooth path just, you know, down the highway, is it? We hope it is, but it isn't, is it? So things arise, don't they? We practice, we live our spiritual life, you know, everything's going along, but things arise from deep within us, past experiences that we haven't resolved. And, you know, we have to look at those feelings, have to embrace those feelings, and sometimes we just go off in other directions, don't we? Not where we thought we were going. Change isn't kind of linear. It's not, you can't kind of map it out. It just doesn't seem to be like that, in my experience, having lived a reasonable length of time. So sometimes I think it feels as though you have to go back before you can go forward. You're not really going back, are you? You're kind of broadening or embracing something on a deeper level before you can, move forward, but there's more of you moving forward. So I think, you know, that's the lessons in this particular story, that, you know, those pulls for us are very, very strong. We may have those kind of dreams, those kind of experiences might arise for us, and, you know, we shouldn't kind of shouldn't be having those experiences. You have to allow them to come into consciousness, see what happens. You know, we have to resolve our past, as it were. For Minarepa, it's a very, very strong and radical experience. It is the experience where he does finally see through conditioned existence. It may not be like that for us yet. And on that basis, you know, he can continue on the path he'd chosen to be a solitary hermit. So it's just a very strong story, I think, very poignant. So the other thing that happens as a result of this is he's gone back home and all this has happened and he's renounced the world and he's going to go off and meditate in caves, but he stays in the area, so he comes in contact with previous family members. He comes in contact with his aunt, who kind of throws refuse at him and beats him. He comes in contact with his uncle, who's not that pleased to see him either. He comes in contact with Zese, who he's engaged to, and eventually comes in contact with his sister. So he has a positive effect on all these people. Zese, I think, is one of the people he comes across first, and she's very kind to him and she brings him alms and stuff, because at this point he is living up in a cave. He's got very, very little. He's starting to go green because of the nettles and all this, and the clothes and so on. And she brings him alms, so she's, you know, she's kind to him. She does turn to the Dharma, but she doesn't want to live that kind of life, the life of a yogi. His aunt is initially very abusive, and then she has a bit more contact with him. She's very scheming, because he now owns the house and the field. He doesn't really want them, but she wants them, so she kind of schemes. But after quite a long time, due to having contact with Minarepa, and I suppose he doesn't bear any grudges, you know, he's changed so much. He's kind of patient with her, kind with her, that eventually she turns to the Dharma. So this is the aunt who caused so much trouble, and she becomes a realized yogini. His sister, lots of stories about Minarepa and his sister. This is quite a sad sort of part of the story, because she's had such a hard life. You know, she was thrown out of her home when she was quite little, and, you know, she's had all the troubles she's had. So she's overjoyed to find Minarepa. She's overjoyed to find her brother again, but she finds him and he is this naked, hairy, green, shriveled, naked person. And she's pleased, I think she's pleased he's a Dharma practitioner, but she, what she wants really is for him to be a big, successful lama with lots of kind of parasols and, you know, offerings and disciples. So she keeps saying that sort of thing to him, you know, why didn't you just, you know, live like that? How can you live like this? So it's very sort of poignant between the two of them, and he's very, very patient with her. And eventually, after a long time, she also turns to the Dharma. She becomes one of his foremost female yogini disciples. So he has a very positive effect on his family, and you know, maybe that's the other lesson from this part of the story for us. I mean, sometimes I don't know what your family relations are like, but you know, often our family aren't that necessarily that kind of supportive of our Dharma practice. I mean, I know my mum for a long time, you know, why didn't I have a proper job, and why didn't I have any money, and why didn't I have any children, and you know, all those kind of things. She wasn't very happy about my life choices, but eventually she thought I was wonderful. You know, so managed to sort of turn around that relationship. So I think that's very important, that these kind of given karmic relationships, aren't they? We don't sort of choose, well, we might choose them in the Bardo, but we don't consciously choose them, do we? We're born into a family. It's our very strong karmic connections. Our Dharma practice can have an effect on those relationships. It may be just initially that we change our internal feelings towards our family members, and you know, gradually learn to let go of resentments and hatreds. And if you've had those kind of things, you may have a very, very happy family. So you know, that's very, very important for our own spiritual practice. But I also believe that, you know, we can change relationships. It might take quite a long time, but we can change our relationships with our family. They may not turn to the Dharma in this life, but the fact that we are practicing and they have a connection with us that hopefully becomes more and more positive, I think has a positive effect on them. So there's a kind of message there, isn't there, to not give up. Not give up on your family. So I just wanted to tell that story, because it touches me very deeply, my own relationship with my mother, I suppose. And I think it just has a lot of lessons for us to reflect upon. So from this point on, Nirupa meditates. He doesn't see Marpa again. He meditates in remote caves, and he continues his practice until he becomes fully enlightened. But I did say last week that I would this week get around to talking about Milarepa's relationship with Marpa, so this talk falls into kind of two halves, so we're going to move on to the second half. So we know quite a lot about his relationship with Marpa from the bits of the life I've told so far. In a way, it falls into sort of three sections. There's his meeting with Marpa. You know, he's pointed at Marpa, isn't he, by a previous teacher. And he knows he needs the Dharma. He knows he needs a teacher. And he has this very strong faith response to just hearing Marpa's name. He knows he's got a karmic connection. But then Marpa puts him through all those ordeals, the building of the houses and the tearing of the houses down that we talked about last week. And then it says, you know, when Marpa realises he's purified, Marpa becomes mild after being sort of seemingly cross and angry and difficult. And he gives Milarepa the teachings and the initiations and then guides him in his practice. You know, he's a bit brusque, Marpa, but he's kind. He's kind, supportive, you know, and he goes off to India to find this special teaching. And then there's the parting, that very emotional, kind of poignant parting. And after that, their connection is purely imaginative, emotional, archetypal, you could say. So I think when we talk about their relationship, we probably tend to focus on the ordeals, because we think, that's terrible. How can you treat Milarepa like that? It's shocking. And we try to make some kind of sense of it. But it's not the biggest part of the relationship, is it, actually? It's the smallest part, probably, in terms of time. He probably was meditating with Marpa much longer than he was undergoing the ordeals. And even in this lineage, Marpa says to Milarepa that the way he was trained and the way he trained Milarepa will not be appropriate for Milarepa's disciples or later disciples. So that's relief, isn't it? So Milarepa was certainly challenging to his own disciples. He wanted to be sure that people were genuinely motivated by the Dharma, and if they wanted to follow him, he wanted to be really sure that they knew what they were in for, because his life was the life of a wandering yogi. But he didn't put them through those kind of ordeals. So I wanted to set it in some kind of context. I also think that that kind of intense ordeal that Milarepa goes through with Marpa, and Marpa goes through with Naropa, and Naropa goes through with Talopa, so it is quite a strong part of this particular lineage, is not that common in Buddhism overall. I don't think it's kind of representative. It's there, but most people don't beat the disciples. Not, I hope, in the FWBO. Anyway. it's there a bit in the Zen tradition, isn't it? But it's not sort of representative, and it's obviously with Milarepa it's for a very strong purpose. Marpa saw that he needed to be purified because he'd been so unskillful. So I want to set it in context a little bit, and set it in Milarepa's lineage. So Milarepa's lineage, as we know, starts with Talopa through Naropa through Marpa, and we've been studying that in this class. And in the main, it's a lineage of yogis or Mahasiddhas. So Talopa was a wild yogi. Naropa starts as a monk, but he's not cutting it as a monk, so you know he knows it's not working, so he goes off to find Talopa. He becomes a wild yogi. Marpa's a layman, Milarepa's a yogi. So they're tantric, Vajrayana, yogic practitioners. They don't live in monasteries, they live out in the wilds, they're unconventional, they're uncompromising, they do whatever they feel like doing. So it's this kind of lineage. And when the lineage comes to Tibet through Marpa, it's called the Kagyu lineage, which means oral lineage. So there's a very strong emphasis on an oral transmission through this lineage. It's the lineage of the word, it's the ear-whispered lineage, or secret lineage. And Milarepa says, the teachings of the whispered lineage are the Dakini's warm breath, which is a lovely image, isn't it, that this kind of whispered teaching oral lineage is the Dakini's warm breath. I hope you understand what a Dakini is, a sort of symbol of inspiration. So you get the idea that the teachings in this lineage and in other Vajrayana lineages are communicated orally. They're even whispered, as it were, from guru to disciple. And this image of the Dakini's warm breath suggests that and evokes that the communication is very personal, very intimate. It's warm, it's close, and also it's free and spontaneous. So this lineage also has a very strong emphasis on practice, on meditation and experience, rather than on book learning or study. So it's also called the practice lineage. It's not that the teachers in this lineage didn't understand or study the Dharma, but the emphasis is on meditation practice. And the teachings are often called the pith teachings. So Milarepa often says in his songs, I give you the pith teaching. So much Dharma available, isn't there? So what Milarepa and the gurus in this lineage are concerned with is giving the disciple the essence of the Dharma, what they need at that moment. Very pertinent. It's also, in the lineage, a very strong emphasis on devotion. There's a quote about the lineage, it says, we train by devotion, not by debate. So the implication is that by cultivating devotion to your teacher and to the teachers of your lineage, you become open and receptive, and that allows you to receive their blessing, which is, of course, is the Dharma. So sometimes it's called the lineage of great blessings. So very strong emphasis on practice and oral tradition, and this kind of emphasis on devotion, on opening up to your teacher and the teachers of the lineage. Now Chogyam Trungpa, who is of this lineage also, I think he's translating something from the Tibetan, calls it the crazy wisdom lineage, doesn't he? And he says, well, Talopa was mad, Marpa was bad-tempered, Milarepa was a murderer. Takes all sorts, really. And it's got this kind of yogic, unconventional aspect. There's also a sort of diversity of lifestyle. So you've got the yogis, the mad yogis, you've got Marpa as the layman, and later on you've got Gampopa as the physician monk. So it's mainly yogic, but it embraces other lifestyles. So. And so this crazy wisdom idea, there is in the songs of Minarepa an amusing meeting between Minarepa and an Indian yogi called the Dumpa Sanjay. And so they're both kind of realised, and they have one of these wacky communications that people have, you know, when they're both realised. And the Dumpa Sanjay says to Minarepa, "You're quite mad." And Minarepa sings this song called the Lunatic Song. Men say, "Is not Minarepa mad? I also think it may be so. Now listen to my madness. The father and son are mad, and so are the transmission. Mad too are my great-grandfather, Talopa, and my grandfather, Naropa, the great scholar. Mad too is my father, Marco the translator. So too is Minarepa." So, yes, there's this kind of emphasis on freedom, spontaneity, nonconformity. But because the lineage is oral, there's an emphasis on the oral transmission and the intimate nature of that communication. There's a very strong emphasis in this lineage and in other Vajrayana lineages on the relationship between the guru and the disciple. It's a central relationship. And here the guru is not just the guru, but the guru is the Vajra guru. And in a lecture by Bhante, Bhante says of the Vajra guru, the Vajra guru is the real, true, authentic guru. Concerned with direct experience, the guru who means business, the no-nonsense guru. He doesn't mind what he does to the disciple. He pushes the disciple towards direct experience beyond words, theories and books. And Marpa is the great example of the Vajra guru in this sense. So, you know, you get a sense of the lineage that Minarepa chooses to become part of. He knows he needs the Dharma, he knows he needs a teacher. The name, hearing the name Marpa and meeting Marpa, he has this great upsurge of faith. He knows they've got a karmic connection. And elsewhere in the songs, he says, "I heard his name and my mind was stunned and numb. Meeting him changed my whole outlook. And at first sight, I knew he was my Lama in all my lives. In the beginning, I met the right person and I put myself in the hands of Marpa." So he also says, if you remember, when he first asked Marpa to be his teacher, "I give myself to you, body, speech and mind." So, you know, he's entered a very strong bond with Marpa. But his association with Marpa is voluntary. It's his choice. Though, of course, Marpa also has to agree, which takes him some time. So in Minarepa's case, there's this immediate karmic connection with Marpa. But more traditionally, in the Vajrayana, if you're thinking of entering into this kind of relationship with a Vajra guru, and forming that kind of bond or samaya, which you would only do at the later stages of the path, quite far on, you would be around that particular teacher for 12 years, so it's said. So you'd hang around for 12 years. I mean, you'd be practicing in a more Mahayana way, but you'd have a sense of the teacher, whether the teacher was the person you wanted to practice with, and they'd be wondering whether you're the disciple they would like to take on. So entering into that kind of relationship, this one-on-one Vajra Guru-disciple relationship, is not taken lightly in the tradition. And especially because it involves, at this stage, you know, very far on along the path, seeing the Guru as the Buddha and not criticising or finding fault with your Guru. So all that is also formalised into a practice called the Guru Yoga. The Guru Yoga is a practice of Tibetan Buddhism, in all the traditions in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a practice to attune your heart and mind to the heart and mind of the Guru. So it's a formal practice that people do where they have their Guru above their head, and you express or cultivate devotion and you feel the blessings of the Guru. So the idea is that you cultivate respect, devotion, faith, gratitude, openness, and that brings you the blessings of the Dharma. So Minarepa says, "Merging self and mind with the Guru brings great inspiration, encouragement and joy." So it's a very positive experience. So it's a method which has a purpose and it has a very strong effect if you engage in it. And I think Minarepa is the great exemplar of Guru Yoga. He knows the formal practice, but it's almost as though he just does Guru Yoga. He lives Guru Yoga. He does it all the time. He doesn't have to sort of think about it. He doesn't have to sit down and do it, as it were. He's done it in initially serving Marpa through all the ordeals and then by practicing intensively, because he says to Marpa, "I can't repay you for the gift of the Dharma. The only way I can repay you is to meditate for the rest of my life." And he begins every song, if not every song, and every cycle of songs with an invocation to Marpa. So you get the sense that he never feels separated from Marpa. He's with him all the time. This is part of his ongoing experience. He never forgets him. He's always there for inspiration and guidance. And he says things like, at the beginning of a song, "Upon the sun, moon, orb of the lotus seat sits my gracious guru Marpa, the divine embodiment of the Buddha Vajradhara." So, you know, he imagines him sitting on a lotus above his head, which is how you do the practice. But it's like he's always there with Marpa. He never doesn't do that. Or he starts a song saying, "I pray to you, my guru, to whom I owe immense gratitude." So this is the kind of lineage that Milarepa is part of and expresses his relationship with Marpa. So we might think, well, how does all that relate to us now? So I think we live in a very different cultural context from medieval Tibet. I suppose in that tradition, even with his previous teachers, you know, he committed himself to serve them in a particular kind of way. You look up to parents, you look up to elders, and we don't live in that kind of society, do we? So I think some of these ideas, or practices as it were, transported, or if you try and transport them lock, stock and barrel to the West, you know, the idea of the crazy wisdom lineage and putting your disciples through all kinds of ordeals of an extreme kind, or even of seeing the guru as the Buddha and not having any criticisms or seeing any faults in your teachers, can lead to a lot of misunderstanding and confusion, and I think probably has done. I mean, it may work also in some situations, but so it's a very, very different world. And I remember Bhante saying a very long time ago to someone that in an ideal world he would like to see Tibetan Buddhism everywhere, because I think that's where his heart lies, as it were. But he was very clear that, you know, we live in a very different situation, and his kind of motivation is to make the Dharma accessible here and now for us in the world we live in. So in a seminar that I read, Bhante makes an interesting distinction when he's talking about this kind of area. He says, you can see teachers, as it were, either as the bearer of the archetype or the exemplar of the ideal. So you can see a teacher as the bearer of the archetype or as the exemplar of the ideal. So in a practice of guru yoga, as it were, and you're seeing your guru as the Buddha, and you're seeing your teacher guru as the bearer of the archetype. In that moment for you, they are the Buddha. They're bearer of the archetype of enlightenment, perfection, truth, Dharmakaya. So it's quite a strong, you know, you're encouraging a very strong positive projection in order to develop devotion, in order to be receptive and receive the blessings. On the other hand, you know, you can be with other practitioners, friends, Dharma Sangha members, and you see other people expressing qualities that you would like to develop, and they're expressing them a little bit more than you can at the moment. So you see someone who is more consistently kinder than you manage to be, and with whatever positive qualities. So in that sense, this is what Bhante means by the exemplar of the ideal. So, you know, you want to be kinder. You see someone else doing that. That's inspiring for you. And in this discussion, Bhante says that if we have difficulties with projection, which we probably do in the West because we're not quite sure how that all works, it's not part of our... the traditional context is not part of our context. It's safer to keep the bearer of the archetype for teachers of the past, because they're dead. You know, we don't rub up against their faults and failings. We can kind of see them in that kind of way. So those sort of teachers of the past on the refuge tree, we can, if we do the refuge tree practice, or we're exploring Minarepa, you know, we can have a very strong inspirational response. And otherwise, you know, the people around you, well, you know, allow their qualities to naturally reveal themselves to you, and they'll be, it's still a bit of a strange expression, isn't it, exemplars of the ideal. So I think that's kind of interesting in the relationship with the guru and how we might deal with it. And he also goes on to say that it seemed, maybe because it was developed as part of their tradition, easier for Tibetans to kind of make a distinction. So he says that Dada Rinpoche said, when he's meditating, when he was meditating on his teacher in a guru yoga type fashion, well, for him he would be the Buddha, but when he was meeting him in normal life, then it would be a more human relationship. And there's a story about the Dalai Lama, isn't there? The Dalai Lama had two, I think, very important teachers, and he said, when I was meditating upon them in this sort of guru yoga method, it was very easy for me to see them as the Buddha and not see their faults or failings. But those teachers were in conflict. They had very strong conflict. So he says, when I was in sort of ordinary life, as it were, I disagreed with the fact that they were in conflict. So there's an ability to discriminate there, isn't there, between using the guru as a method and not getting caught up with thinking that, you know, all order members have to be perfect, or whatever we do, you know, those, or we have to be perfect. We get caught up in those kind of projections and ideas, don't we? So they seem to find it easier to sort of shift levels and discriminate and hold those things together rather more easily than we do. So I think it's interesting in our own version of the guru yoga, which we call the Kalyana Mitra yoga, which we do as order members because it's based on going for refuge, it's the same lineup, as it were, as the going for refuge and prostration practice. So you have the Buddha, here you have the Buddha at the top, the Buddha Shakyamuni at the top, the gurus of the past, the teachers of the past, and then immediately above your head you have your preceptor, and your preceptor, and your preceptor, and your preceptor's preceptor, and your preceptor's preceptor's preceptor, but Bhante would be there. So it's the same purpose, is to kind of open, you know, to be receptive, to open oneself. And I think that the verse that we say as order members, when we do that practice, is quite interesting, because we say, I entreat you, O Buddha Shakyamuni, revealer of the Dharma, and you, great gurus of the past and present, who have realized its essence, and you, Urgyan Sangharakshita, who has given me the gift of the Dharma. Please witness my going for refuge and grant me your blessing. So all you're saying about Bhante is, thank you, you've given me the gift of the Dharma. It's very simple, isn't it? It's very sort of straightforward. It's like he's your doorway, as it were, my doorway, to the Dharma and to the other members of the lineage. It doesn't say anything about his attainments, his realisation. It's just very simple and straightforward. So we know in our movement that Bhante has encouraged emphasis on individual practice in the context of friendship, Kalyana Mitra, and spiritual community, rather than this very loaded badger, guru and disciple relationship. So we can come along and we can just come along to a centre, we can learn to meditate, and we can come to classes, we can go on retreat, we can go to the cherry orchard, we can help out, we can, you know, come into contact with one another, we can make friends with one another. You know, that may take time, but we can do that. And if that's a direction you want to go and you want to get more deeply involved, you can become a Mitra if you want to. If you're a Mitra, if you want to, you can ask two order members to become your Kalyana Mitras. But you would only do that if you knew two order members well enough that you wanted to be in that kind of relationship with them. The same if you want to join the order. At some point, hopefully, you'll find an order member who's senior enough to be your preceptor. But we hope that that kind of all happens quite naturally through you being around, you being in contact, you're making connections, making friendships. So this is how we go about all that. I mean, maybe it's equivalent to the hanging around for 12 years in the tantric tradition. Hope it doesn't take that long. So I think it's interesting, you know, to find a connection back to Milarepa's lineage, that Gampopa, one of his chief disciples, continuing his lineage, in the book he wrote, The Dual Ornament of Liberation, there's a chapter on spiritual friendship. And he says it's crucial to have spiritual friends. It's crucial to have friends. And he mentions different categories of friends. So there's a Buddha, and there's a high realized bodhisattva, slightly less realized bodhisattva. And then there's an ordinary human spiritual friend. And he says, well, if you're going to ask which is the greatest benefactor, it's the ordinary human spiritual friend. So it's someone close to us, someone, you know, maybe done a little bit more practice than us, who can illumine the path for us. It's someone that can help us, you know, immediately help us. He says you may you won't be able to tell if someone's a highly realized bodhisattva. You just can't tell, because it takes one to know one. So you just relate to people around you. However, we do need to take responsibility for ourselves. I mean, Milarepa had the strong karmic connection, but he did choose to practice with Marpa. He tried to get away sometimes, but he stayed with it, didn't he? And I think everybody here needs to take responsibility for themselves. So if you want to be part of this community, if you eventually want to be part of the order, I think it's up to you to find out as much about us as you can, to know what you're letting yourself in for, actually, to ask questions, to find out what principles we're based on, to find out about our history, to find out if this is really where you want to be. So we do need to exercise our choice, our common sense and our discrimination. You may meet someone and feel an immediate karmic connection, in which case you can explore that and see where that leads. So we're in a very different cultural context, but I still think we can take something from Minarepa's example and from the example of his lineage, and I think that is a willingness to be appreciative and think of the conditions that we have, our teachers, our friends, the fact that we've been given the gift of the Dharma, with gratitude. It's not that everything has to be perfect, but at least we can appreciate what we've been given. And I think that mental event of gratitude, of opening, of just being appreciative, does give rise to faith, and that kind of opens us to the Dharma. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, you might not be thinking this, how about a bit of ordeal? Maybe you want a bit of ordeal in your life. You'd be slapped around the face by a fish or a sandal or something. I don't know. Go off and build a house. We've built lots of things in the FWP in our time. But maybe we've got enough of an ordeal, as it were, or a challenge. Maybe it's a challenge rather than an ordeal. Just to be honest and authentic in our practice. Just to keep practicing, just to get on the cushion, if we can do that every day, just to learn to communicate effectively. I mean, that's enough of a challenge, isn't it? Just to not get into conflict with people, just to resolve our conflicts if we've got them, to keep developing our friendships. If you want a bit more of a challenge, then you can always take part in the ordination training. So perhaps we don't need more than all that. What our practice throws up for us is probably challenging enough for most of us. And we just need to keep going. So I hope that gives you a little bit of the context of the relationship between Marpa and Minarepa. In Minarepa's case, those ordeals were necessary for him. Marpa saw that from his enlightened state of mind, with his spiritual intuition, that Minarepa needed to be purified. He wasn't going to get anywhere until then. Once that's over, it's over. He doesn't continue making him build houses. He builds the house of meditation, as it were, but he becomes mild, and he gives him the teachings, and he supports him in going to risk his own life, going off to India and so on. So there's a change in the relationship. It's not ordeal for the sake of ordeal. And I hope that although this took place in a different time, in a different cultural context, we can see ways that we can take inspiration from Minarepa's life, his practice, his lineage, and his relationship with Marpa. So I do want to end with one of Minarepa's outpourings towards Marpa. So this is one of the songs of Minarepa, and he says, "At times you will think of your guru. Whenever such yearning arises, visualizing upon your head and for his blessings pray. Visualize him sitting in your heart and forget him never. But you should know that even your guru is delusory and dreamlike, that all things are unreal and magical." Thank you.